Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh, and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing the roles, lives, and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 1, Sunday, January the 20th, 2008. Guests include Tony O'Sullivan, Curator of Astronomical Instruments for Salford Astronomical Society, Chris Lord, Administrator of Braybrook Observatory, Ken Irving, Director of the Observatory at Salford Astronomical Society. Topics of discussion today include: what has amateur astronomy come to? Who was the founder of amateur astronomy in the UK? And Comet Holmes, how likely is it to outburst again? You might have heard that there was an asteroid targeting Mars for an impact at the end of this month, January 2008. Well, actually, it looks as if it's going to miss. It's a pity, because it would have been quite an interesting event, given that there are a couple of spacecraft in orbit and, of course, the two rovers on the surface. Something else that happened earlier this month was the MESSENGER space probe to Mercury, which is slowly winding its way to an orbit which it will achieve in March 2011. But last week, January the 14th, it actually made our first visit to Mercury, and it managed to take the first image of Mercury since the 1970s, in Mariner 10 visit, which visited Mercury three times but never managed to take any photographs of the other hemisphere. Last week, MESSENGER did just that. Chris Lord, you probably know Chris from his long interest in astronomy. He's been associated with the Braybrook Observatory for many years, and he's the administrator there. Chris, what's amateur astronomy coming to? You had some thoughts on this a while ago.
What prompted me to put it on was mainly to do with the motivations of serious amateur astronomers. To me, amateur astronomy should be done primarily because it's a source of enjoyment. And indeed, for most people, when they get into the hobby, that's precisely what it is. You have a fascination with the night sky and you wish to pursue it. And you may join a local astronomical society, and you may join later a national astronomical society. And getting involved in the National Astronomical Society's observing sections. What I noticed, it happened to me, and it certainly happened to a good deal of the number of people who were into astronomy to the same level that I was, that you ended up being dragooned into making observations that at first you wanted to make, and then became a chore. So what started out as being an interest became an unpaid job that you weren't really wanting to do. It made me wonder what the motivations were of the people who actually stuck with it through thick and thin over decades. I couldn't honestly believe in my own mind that they were so occupied with wanting to discover comets, asteroids, supernovae, call it what you will, that they would call off whatever happened to be booked as a social engagement on a spur of the moment, decade after decade after decade. Still to this day, I think a lot of it is to do with a quest for kudos, which is the worst motivation for being an observer. The best is curiosity, And that's what gets people into it in the first place. But you have to beware. It's a double-edged sword. And you end up, or you can, if you're not careful, persisting in a form of observation that you're no longer really keen on. You committed yourself to it, you've earned yourself a reputation, and you daren't let that reputation become compromised.
We also have here Tommy O'Sullivan, who's the curator of instruments at Salford Astronomical Society, and Ken Irving, who's the director of the observatory. I guess you two guys, you really enjoy observing, don't you?
Oh, I do, yeah. No doubt about it. You get a great deal of satisfaction being under a nice dark sky and being able to sort of explore the universe. Because some of the things I've seen with my warm eyes through my telescope,
yeah,
you know, stay with you forever.
Yeah.
The wonderful views I've had. And knowledge about the objects you're looking at enhances that. Because then you're aware that that stellar point you're looking at actually isn't just a star. It happens to be a quasar with a massive black hole at the centre of it. And sometimes you do contribute to the greater knowledge by producing observations and then going forward to people like the Webb Society and the BAA. But overall, my driving force really is the intensity of my astronomy grows, mainly because my enthusiasm for it always seems to go higher with each passing year. And technology has come along now and allowed me to do things that I could have even dreamt of doing, you know, 20 odd years ago. In so much as we can image down to 20th magnitude from an urban site in Manchester, you know, which none of us would have believed possible, you know, all them years ago.
That's right, and that was one of your interests, Ken, wasn't it? Deep sky objects. Do you reckon, given the pollution that we've had experience of the last two decades, modern technology overcomes that?
It doesn't fully overcome it, but it goes partway to solving the problem. I think, as both of our previous speakers have said, there's a main, let's say, thrust in amateur astronomy, and I say it's threefold, really. In the first instance, is obviously the enjoyment you get as an individual yourself. The second thing is it's transmitting that enthusiasm and, you know, the information, what have you, to other people, trying to enthuse them in the same thing. And the third thing, as Chris mentioned, is providing scientific data, observations to, you know, the archiving organisations. Mm-hmm. So on that basis, I think my main thrust has been two things, really. I've not really been a data provider. You know, I will occasionally provide observations on the subject of deep sky or what have you, like Tony says, to the Webb Society, or photographs to various magazines and things like that. But that's basically about as far as it goes. I'm not a drudge from the point of view of religiously going out providing data night after night. Where my main thing is in getting other people involved. Because what you tend to find out is you get, I don't know, over the years, I don't know how many hundreds of people involved and interested in the science, right? Then obviously the spin-off from that is that some of them will go down this road of being, you know, data providers or what have you. So imaging's always been a big part of my theme. And what I've always wanted to do is try and sort of provide images which are realistic with respect to what you see in the sky. That is not the pretty Hubble colour pictures, but the actual faint, shimmery, fuzzy blob sort of images of what you actually tend to see visually through a telescope. Okay, they're enhanced slightly from the point of view of contrast and all the rest of it, but more or less to give people a realistic feel on what, you know, they are likely to see when they look through a telescope. So that's been one of my main goals and ambitions throughout the years.
Well, I don't know if you guys saw this programme about the amateur astronomy community over Christmas called Starmen.
Yeah.
I was surprised to hear, there was a quote there, I think Heather Cooper was the narrator. She was saying that there's about 40,000 amateur astronomers in the UK. Do you go along with that?
Yeah, I would think so. Well, based on the sales of astronomy.
Well, see, you take people's interest, right? Obviously, that level of interest can vary from being the guy who'll go into a newsagent and buy the odd astronomy magazine every month or or on the odd occasion, right, to somebody who's totally absorbed in the subject and you know, devotes quite a lot of his spare time to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a big range, really, and I think a lot of people have got an interest in the universe.
January edition of Sky Night magazine, which has the free CD on the front every month, completely disappeared off all the newsagent shows.
Yeah.
And once again, I would reckon that that is because people, you know, bought their sons and daughters or what have you, some kind of telescope or something for Christmas. Often bought the magazine off the newsagent shelf and they all disappear.
Was she just referring to people with a casual interest in this 40,000 feet?
Well, no, she was describing the what she considered to be the essence of the amateur astronomer. She used this expression, or she reminded us that the word amateur comes from the
Greek word
amor, which is love, which I suppose has been responsible for places like the Taj Mahal or some abdications of some monarchs in the past and even the Trojan Wars. But you reckon, Chris, that's where you believe passionately amateur astronomers really should be?
Yes, I do,
Doing astronomy for the love of it.
I would have put the figure something. The last time I had a figure about it, amateur astronomers in this country, the number did about 22,000. That's based on sales of magazines, and I actually, from what I've heard, the sales of magazines have actually dropped, not gone up. It's, no, if you include people with a casual interest in it, I suppose it will come to about 40,000, I suppose.
I think the way to look at the data really is, what's the membership of the BAA, what's the sales of Astronomy Now, which is a British magazine, what's the sales of Sky at Night, because most people will buy more than one magazine, plus some of us buy the American magazines as well.
Yeah. You see, the one thing that worries me, it's concerned me for a long time as well, is that the hobby's got an ageing demographic. By which I mean, when you go to meetings, you see, well, we're all middle-aged, so we see the same people, middle-aged people. You don't see so many young people. I mean, when I was getting into the hobby, and when Tony and Ken were getting into the hobby, getting on for 40 years ago now, isn't it? We were all young people, and all right, you went to a local astronomical society, and there were all the old boys there, and you'd look up to them, and they'd say the odd word that you might understand, but most of it you didn't. But there was loads of young people to talk to. Mm-hmm. When a young person shows up at a local astronomical society now, it's a novelty. Mm-hmm. It really is. And when you go to a meeting, like a Web Society annual general meeting or something like this, there are very few people in the 20s and 30s there.
Well, I think
the bulk of the younger people you see, they have to be in the 40s.
Yeah, well, that's really an aspect of the internet, if you want, but I think, because when I joined Software Astronomical Society, I joined it in my mid-20s, right, and got married, you know, family and all the rest of it, and I was looking for, you know, to further my interest in astronomy, and I discovered the society existed, and made moves to go and see what they're about. In them days, if you wanted further information about astronomy, you really had to join a society to try and get more information, because people there would be able to point you in the right direction. They wouldn't do it for you, but they'd be able to say to you, right, well, you know, by Burnham's, you know, they're a really good, you know, set of books that'll teach you a lot, you know, you'll learn a lot from that. And that was what happened. It was really like a guiding hand, which enhanced, you know, your abilities, right, and your knowledge in astronomy, which, you know, it's sort of self-fulfilling, isn't it, then? Because one thing brings on more. And it was a realisation, then, of what's right and what's wrong, and the good things to do and the bad things to avoid. You know, astronomy's developed a lot. I think the internet's stopped a lot of the youngsters coming along, right, and I think that's because they can get all the information they want. If they have an interest, they can go on the Google and find out what they want to find out, you know, from the comfort of their own bedroom on the laptop, and they've got the information there to hand.
In those days, 206-inch telescope were a year of royalty. You know, so what happened was you joined a society because generally you had access to a big instrument as well as all the nowadays, that's gone by the board. Large instruments are not necessary. If you're going to go down the imaging road, for instance, which obviously a lot of people do, an 8-inch telescope, let's say, is adequate for virtually everything an amateur astronomer wants to actually do. And they're cheap, they're easily available, and the quality is absolutely second to none, you know, for value for money. So I think from that point of view, the whole sort of regime of the amateur astronomer has actually changed dramatically over the years. Sure, I agree with Tony, the information side of it has also been a revolution. And as he says, you know, there's most probably plenty of people who are keenly interested in astronomy, but essentially just do it online. Don't actually go and do astronomy out in the back garden or what have you, which is what we tend to do.
Yeah, but does that undermine their claim to being an
astronomer? No, I wouldn't take anything away. Everybody's got an interest in astronomy, really.
Stat Night Chart, that's in the Times newspaper all the time, and they're fully up to date with what's going on in the sky. Mm-hmm. But we just pick it up from a popular newspaper.
Well, you do find that. I've been out to, like at lunar eclipses, and when I've gone onto the moors to do some observing, and I've had a great crowd of people join me up there because they've been aware, you know, that there's an event happening, right? And to see somebody, you know, in a car park with a telescope, you know, it's amazing the crowds you can get around you, you know, where people are just interested to see the spectacle. But if you get an astronomical event occurring at a reasonable time, the vast majority of people might be interested to have a look at it. And definitely, you know, you've only got to look at the transit of Venus.
Yeah.
You know, and the public interest in that, where people might not do astronomy on a weekly basis, but for that one day, they were interested to see, you know, this event occur, and went along to star parties and all sorts of things, you know, to gain access to telescopes which they wouldn't consider buying themselves. But obviously they would love to talk too.
Well, thanks so much, Tony, for not pointing at me when you said earlier there's so many people who have these telescopes but never take them out. Your temperature goes up a little bit.
Maybe as soon as it stops raining.
As well.
You're a fair weather observer, Gooby. That's what it is.
I'm a warm weather observer, that's the problem. Tomorrow, 21st of January, marks the 220th anniversary of the birth of William Henry Smyde. Now, Chris, you reckon he was the founder of amateur astronomy here in the UK?
I reckon he was the founder of amateur astronomy per se. I'm not saying that an interest in observation of astronomy started in British Isles, it certainly didn't. But the pursuit of astronomy as a hobby by people of working class background, people with limited income, rather than grand amateurs, as Alan Chapman calls them, had its origins with a book published by Smyde in 1844 called The Cycle of Celestial Objects. And that was the first handbook of astronomy ever written. A description of objects in the sky that you could look at through a telescope that if you had a reasonable income, you could afford to go out and buy and use. And it was the inspiration of Webb's Common Objects for
Celestial Objects
for Common Telescopes, published in 1859. Yeah. So the inspiration for Webb's book was Smyde's book. And
what kind of time span are we looking at there?
Well, he published his book in 1844, and he was an old man, really, when he published the book. And he published two follow-ups to it. One was a commentary on it, published at the Bedford Observatory in the 1852, I think it was called. And then there was a second volume to that, A.D.'s Hartwelliana, it was called, which was published in 1857, I think it was. And he died in the 1860s. And Webb's book was first published in 1859. The reason Webb was motivated to produce his book was because A. Smyde's book was out of print, but even when it was in print, it was quite expensive. The actual genre, if you read the first volume of Smyde's book, which you can get as a digital download, you don't have to look for this rare antiquarian book anymore, it's been digitised. If you actually read in volume one, which is a description of instruments and how you use them and the type of observations you can make with them, it uses Victorian flowery prosy language, but it's very much of the sort of language that is still used nowadays in popular astronomy books, if you sort of translate the culture in which it's written to today's culture, the vernacular, as you might put it. And the man's obviously got a love of the subject. He's not going out to observe, like, say, William Herschel and John Herschel and Sir James South. The reason they, as grand amateurs, observed was purposefully to make scientific discoveries. Smythe wasn't interested in making scientific discoveries. He was interested in observing these objects for their own sake. And it's the first time, really, that it was ever done. Everybody else before had gone out to make an observation through a telescope for a specific reason. You had to justify your own existence for some peculiar reason. He altered the culture.
Right.
And then Webb, who also was cast very much in the same mould, had been observing throughout the same period of time that Smythe had, he followed on and made amateur astronomy through his book more available for people with even a lower income. A working class artisan, someone earning something like, say, 10 shillings a week, with the onset of the invention of the silver on glass reflecting telescope, would be in a position where he could, over a period of time, build his own telescope and then, using Webb's book, use it for meaningful observations, again, just to satisfy their own curiosity.
Well, this is a fairly good case for Smythe being the founder. Quite a few amateur astronomers out there usually have very large 10-inch plus size telescopes, CCDs with very fast computers and fancy software, and they usually retired on healthy pension. I suppose those would be top end of the amateur astronomy community now. Do they hold, is it right for them to call themselves amateurs?
Yeah. Amateur means you're not being paid for it, basically, but you've got a lot of the subject.
Assuming they're spending their own money.
Yeah. Well, that's it. The thing is, as you say, these people who, you know, especially some of the supernova patrollers and that, they've invested a great deal of money, time and effort, and they're producing scientific information which is...
Well, it's amazing how many amateurs do discover things independently while looking through the telescope. If you go back sort of 20, 40 years ago, like we were talking earlier, when, you know, communication and transmission of information was a lot slower, then we've had occasions where members of society discovered, you know, independently comets that were in the sky, what had been discovered 2 or 3 days before, and the information hadn't got to us.
Now, because they allowed the first three names, and now they're all called linear.
Comet Holmes, 17P Holmes, been keeping a lot of amateur astronomers busy. Ken, I know you've been taking some photographs of it pretty much whenever you can. Why is it called 17P Holmes to start off with?
Well, that's just its designation. I mean, it's periodic, number 17 in the list. And Holmes, being the first discoverer of it way back 120 odd years ago.
Sherlock's brother.
It's 1892, isn't it?
Was it 1892?
Edwin P. Holmes,
that's right.
Well, he had a habit of observing Andromeda, the Rhombus Spiral Galaxy.
Right. Now, the thing,
Basically, you know, he stumbled across this comet, and he did a very similar thing to what it's done this time around, where it outburst, and literally, you know, it was a tremendous revelation, and it's the most amazing comet I've ever seen.
So, what is it you see when you look at it?
Right, well, basically, visually, it's a diffuse ball of luminous gas, for want of a better word. It was basically circular. If you looked at it in more detail, you could see the with the nuclear region, I won't say the nucleus itself, but the nuclear region, you could see there was a bright spot there, but it wasn't in the centre of all the brightness, it was off to one side, as though you were looking down the head of the comet, and you were getting a foreshortened view.
So it looks like a comet, but there's no tail, it's more circular. I understand it's the outburst started in October. When was the first time you saw it, Ken?
It was late October, wasn't it?
It was on 23rd, 24th.
And basically, it's when, you know, several tens of thousands of times brighter than what it would have been. I mean, in other words, its normal brightness would have been down at 17th Mach, which is fainter than most people's telescope, most amateur astronomers' telescopes will show. And the fact that it then brightened up in less than 12 hours to naked eye brightness is absolutely... The reason they think it most probably underwent a similar outburst then was A, because when he discovered it, it was bright. But it's the fact that it was next to the Andromeda Galaxy, which was one of those objects which people would be looking at constantly. There'd be loads of amateurs of the day using the telescopes to look at Andromeda. And the fact that nobody reported it, right, suggests that shortly before Holmes looked at it, it had undergone outbursts. And its behaviour in the way it's faded and that has been very similar this go around as well.
So an outburst is perhaps some sort of explosion on the surface of the comet or within its nucleus, and it's increasing size and brightness many million times or more.
Well, something's made it throw off millions of tons of dust, and that's basically dust and gas, which is obviously expanded from this nucleus area, essentially just filled the space around it, forming the head of the comet, which we call the coma. Now, in actual fact, the dimensions of which the coma is at the moment is larger than the sun. You know, it's a million miles across, you know, thereabouts. Obviously, the pressure from the solar wind and the particles coming off the sun then push against that coma and actually then form the tail. Of the images that have been taken of it and the observations that have been made, obviously, like with all comets, there is some striation in the coma showing that jetting and outburst has happened in particular predetermined directions, let's say. For comets that don't undergo outbursts, just get close to the sun and come bright, then the jetting is very, very pronounced. In this particular case, the jetting is quite subtle, meaning that the amount of material thrown off from the surface all happened very, very quickly and wasn't a continuous sort of outpouring through a jet over many months or weeks or whatever. The mechanisms proposed for this, you know, there are several out there, but one of the to do with the production of hydrogen peroxide on the surface, and because of the distance of the comet, which is just out beyond the orbit of Mars.
So, therefore, it's got nothing to do with whatever the mechanism is. It isn't the sun, because it's now really far away from the sun as it gets.
It's not the sun as in the heat of the sun, but what it is the sun. The sun's particles, right, in the solar wind, you know, can impact on the surface. It can interact with the molecules of water and ice that are in the comet. And the H2O can be converted into H2O2, which is hydrogen peroxide, which has a much lower melting point. Therefore, if you convert the water to hydrogen peroxide, right, then the liquid hydrogen peroxide could then seep through the cracks in the surface and pool somewhere underneath the surface. The thing about hydrogen peroxide is it will very easily dissociate itself back into water and hydrogen, basically just due to the contact with certain earth oxides, you know, such as manganese dioxide and things like that. Anybody who's played around with chemistry in school with hydrogen peroxide and copper oxide or something like that will find out that yes, it fizzes and you get lots of oxygen produced. And water and steam, and it's an exothermic reaction. So once the reaction does start, then obviously there's a warming process available as well. So if there are pools, or there were pools, of hydrogen peroxide under the surface, and then they contacted in some way, some metal oxides incorporated, or even just maybe the metal itself, you know, things like nickel and things like that, in the comet, then an exothermic reaction would start. It would start melting the surroundings, more would combine, and in a very short matter of time you could actually produce a lot of steam, a lot of heat, and break the surface open and throw a lot of tonnage of material out there from such a low gravity object.
Okay, so that's one possible mechanism. Is it important for that mechanism that the comet is away from the sun, that it's in a very colder part of its orbit?
Only the fact that it allows this process to actually happen slowly over the 120 years since it last happened. Yeah. In other words, there is an accumulation over this period.
Right.
obviously, when it first happened, I mean, I suppose a lot of people were thinking, had it been smacked by something, i.e., because it's in the asteroid belt, so had it been whacked by a chunk of material, it doesn't have to be very large,
right.
A 10-metre ball of rock or something might well cause serious damage.
Right. So the trigger for this mechanism needed that period of time, 120 years ago, since it last happened. Perhaps a bit like tectonic plates where the stress builds up over a long period of time, then all of a sudden it goes.
Mm. So having said that, I mean, although comets have brightened in the past before, for it to work like this sort of clockwork mechanism, I think I'm a little bit doubtful myself. You know, because you think about it, okay, it exploded in some fashion 120 years ago. Now, for that same mechanism to actually happen again, is something going on in comets which we don't understand in that case.
And that's why I guess this particular event is so fascinating. Mm. But I understand in the 120 years ago, when it happened before, it actually happened twice, once and then a few months again.
Round about,
now, this January
16th, it brightened again.
But not quite as much.
Mm. But still got naked iron, that was the main thing. Mm. Now, obviously, we don't know if it's brightened, because it's been raining for a week. Get on the internet.
I'd look on the internet at the weekend, and it hadn't brightened. It was still very faint, pale and diffuse.
So 120 years ago, did it, the time of year coincides then? It was in October.
It was November.
It was November.
The same time of year. The interesting thing about that is only the fact that perihelion for the comet is the point where it's closest to the sun, even though it's in a pretty circular orbit of high inclination, is in May. So it's interesting that it's happened at roughly the same time in the orbit, you know, that it did last time. Last time was on November the 5th, as it happens. November 5th and 6th is when it actually exploded. This time it was October the 24th, you know. So, you know, within a few days, it was the same time.
So it really is worth keeping an eye on that for, if it's likely to happen.
Well, you think about it, I mean, okay, the duration between last time and this time has been 120 years. Who's to say it's not going to happen next year? Or, you know, 3 years from now or 10 years from now? You know, we don't know what the mechanism is, so therefore, how can you predict when it's going to happen?
Mm.
All we can do is say, we know what's happened last time, 120 years. It's not like a transit of Venus where you can say, yes, it's going to happen again in 120 years' time. That's not the case.
That's a good place to stop. That's the end of the very first programme. Thanks very much, Chris, Ken and Tony.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. AT UK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on AT UK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.